This podcast is brought to you by ProXPN.com. Get your guard up and reclaim your internet security and privacy with a free ProXPN account. Don't delay. Go to ProXPN.com and get your free VPN account today. And yes, it works on PC or Mac. Thanks, ProXPN.com.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again. Now, this week, we are continuing our Halloween double features for the month of October. We start off with Ancient Aliens Debunked. Ooh, a skeptic. And then we have in our second part of our program, an interview with James Renner about his new book, It Came from Ohio, 13 spooky and some of them supernatural stories from my home state, the state of Ohio. I hope that you'll enjoy both programs, and we thank you so much for tuning in. Now let's get on with it. It is the Paranormal Podcast. Now we're going to take a look at a very popular subject that's on everybody's lips, a very popular television program series, Ancient Aliens, focusing around the idea of ancient astronauts coming from elsewhere. Of course, we know the work of people like Eric Von Däniken, Chariot of the Gods, and all of that. And it's really gained a lot of traction in the last few years. And we've done shows before. Bill Burns has been on the show talking about it previously. We thought we would get a little different, or a lot different perspective on it. Our guest today is Chris White. He is a podcaster with his own Revelations Radio Network, and we'll have him tell us a little bit about that. But for the purposes of this discussion, he's also a documentarian, and he has recently produced a new documentary called Ancient Aliens Debunked. And we're going to talk to him why he thinks, quite frankly, the ancient alien theory is all wet. We do like to get both sides of the house here at the Paranormal Podcast. Chris White, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us today.
Jim, it's a real pleasure to be on the show, and I just really appreciate you having me on.
Now, we chatted a little bit before the show, and going into this, I assume, Chris, you know, he's going to be 100% skeptic of anything that's paranormal or UFO or anything like that, and that's okay, but I just kind of had that sense going in. But in our discussion, you're not really that way at all. It's just this particular topic, I guess, you just don't think it holds water.
No. In fact, I mean, I used to believe the ancient astronaut theory pretty firmly, but it wasn't just that. I mean, I've been a researcher of odd things as far back as I can remember. I'm proudly a conspiracy theorist in many different areas, and I'm really sympathetic to many of the different things. But there's a great deal of things within that realm, within that world, that are easily disproven. But there are other things that I am proudly waving the paranormal flag in certain circumstances.
Well, what got you specifically interested in the area of ancient aliens? Why did you say, I'm going to tackle this and make a 3-hour documentary?
Well, as I said, I was an ancient astronaut theorist. I grew up on the coast to coast of the world, and I picked up Zachariah Sitchin's book. I can't remember which one. I think it was Stairway to Heaven, mm-hmm. in about 2099, 2000, somewhere in there. And so it really kind of snowballed as I continued to research. I found different problems with his theories, and that was kind of the crack in the dam there that eventually led to me really questioning all out the whole thing. And as the years progressed, I kind of had a burden to kind of just tell other people that it was wrong, because it was just, it was something that I think is kind of intellectually dishonest at the end of the day. And it's so, it has so many implications in terms of your worldview and everything else. It was just important, I think, for me. I felt a need almost to go and just tell people, hey, this is wrong. So
now, many people, when they're looking at the ancient aliens theory, they look at things that on the face make sense. You know, you look at hieroglyphics, for example, and it looks like pictures of flying craft. You listen to the record of ancient civilizations, and they talk about chariots in the sky, and you see drawings of what literally look like astronauts with headgear on. It's a pretty appealing argument, and it would seem to make, on the face of it, as it did to you initially, at least, it seems to make some sense, because you have these primitive societies making these huge technological leaps seemingly from nowhere. What's wrong with that line of thinking?
Well, I think that you're onto something in that the reason that it is appealing is because I believe something very out of the ordinary did happen in the ancient past. And the mainstream explanations for a lot of those things are not adequate. And so, but the problem is that the sort of version that I think that we've been given here doesn't explain the evidence. And particularly with these ideas of, as you mentioned, sort of these monuments that we've built, and they were far too technologically advanced. I don't think that that line is true in a lot of different areas. In this film, I talk about some of the main ones: Pumapunku, the pyramids, Baalbek, the Incan sites, Easter Island, those types of things. And I started this whole thing out as a pyramid nerd. I mean, I knew all the alternative theories and believed all the alternative theories almost at the same time about the pyramid and how it was built and everything else. But a lot of these things, when you really research, I spent a year researching these things and more for this film. And I actually went into it thinking, you know, I don't really care what happened with this. You know, I'm just going to continue to research and find out what I can find out about it. And I found out that we as humans really were doing this, and we had the capability and a lot of the things that people say, like about the pyramids and things like that, the Grand Gallery and all these different aspects, are really well explained in various places. So I changed my mind in that I do take a naturalistic view in terms of the building projects and things like that. But
So you say something extraordinary happened, and you said that maybe our current explanations or mainstream explanations really don't account for it. So it sounds like in some cases you're maybe somewhere in between the ancient aliens theorists and maybe mainstream archaeology and so forth. What kind of extraordinary things do you think happened that may be a little bit outside of the normal explanations that we hear from science?
Well, there are, I think, primarily that the ancient mythologies and the like, I don't think a true skeptic could look at the similarities in ancient mythologies, the things that our ancestors truly believed. You know, the idea, for example, of these gods coming to Earth and having sex with human women and producing offspring and things like that, it's not just kind of similar. It's really similar, and people really believed it. And it's not just that; it's all over the place. In all these different mythologies, seem to be singing the same song. And there are very literal natural. There are very few naturalistic explanations for that kind of thing. I think that I give our ancestors a great deal more credit, and in that respect, I'm a lot like the ancient astronaut theorists, in that I do believe that they weren't just insane people that just believed these things. I mean, I think that there was some diffusion. What you can certainly tell in the study of ancient mythology is that they were all kind of adding their own local cultural importance to the stories. But I do believe that that something happened in ancient past. That is more in line with what I think that they're saying, that there was these divine beings that had sex with human women and produced offspring. That's essentially what I'm saying is that I can't disprove as a skeptic. And in the film, I'm catching a lot of heat from that, from the skeptic community. But one thing I don't know how to say it any other way. I don't think a true skeptic could do this justice in these this aspect of it. And what the ancient astronaut theory does is essentially takes – it really is the genesis of the ancient astronaut theory, is they take that issue and they say, well, that was UFOs from another planet. And that's the part that where all the stuff breaks down, and where an ancient alien's debunked, you can see that all the evidence that they put forth to promote that angle of the theory, that these are highly a technologically advanced civilization from a different planet or a different whatever, that's where their theories turn out to be not just bad, but outright lies in some case, fabricating evidence. They are doing a lot of really negative things to get people to believe that version of it. But it presupposes an anti-supernaturalist worldview. If you don't believe that there is anything supernatural out there in terms of different, whatever, in terms of there can't be a divine being that does that and takes supernatural form or human form or anything like that, you have to go with the ancient technologically advanced civilization from another planet. It's your only other option, trying to retain that naturalistic worldview.
Well, right after this break, we're going to talk to Chris White further about his film, or video actually, Ancient Aliens Debunked, a fascinating conversation. Stay tuned to the Paranormal Podcast. Well, we've been telling you about them for the last several weeks. You have to check out ProXPN at proxpn.com. Keep your data, your passwords, everything you hold dear online away from prying eyes, whether that's the prying eyes of a Wi-Fi sniffer at a coffee house or a public place, maybe your neighbor, in fact, if you're using Wi-Fi in your home, or from Big Brother, who is snooping into everything you do. The ISPs are monitoring everything you look at online. Now, I believe in window blinds in my house. Consider this to be window blinds for the internet, and I've got a great deal for you. Can you get any better than free? That's what ProXPN.com is offering. Just go over to JimHerald.com and click on the banner, and you can find, or you can go directly to ProXPN.com, either one, and you can get their basic VPN product for absolutely free. And it will protect you, it will protect your desktop or your laptop from those prying eyes. Now, I've been telling you several weeks, if you haven't done it, and you go to a coffee house and you get yourself hacked by somebody who is intercepting Wi-Fi signals, because after all they are radio signals, I hate to say it, but you have no one to blame but yourself. So stop the show right now. Go over to JimHerald.com, click on the ProXPN banner, to go over to ProXPN.com and sign up for your free ProXPN.com account. Now this will do pretty much everything you needed to do. If you want to get more involved and have this protection also on your mobile devices and so forth, you can select their premium program. But for your desktop or your laptop, go over there, check out their free program. It is a great deal, and we do recommend it. And as I said, there's no better endorsement than if the endorser uses it themselves, and I will not take my laptop out and get on free Wi-Fi without it, period. Won't do it, because I think that, I've been looking for a product like this for a long time, honest to goodness, and that's why I was so glad I met the good folks at ProXPN.com. We thank you so much for your support. And we hope that you'll support ProXPN.com. They went out and supported us with this sponsorship, and we would appreciate it if you would say, hey, thank you, ProXPN.com. And while I'm at it, I'll also protect my PC or my laptop with your free offer. ProXPN.com, free VPN software that will protect your data from prying eyes. Please check it out today. ProXPN.com.
Can't get enough paranormal content? Sign up for monthly webinars, newsletters, and more shows. Join the Paranormal Plus Club at jimherald.net. Now back to the Paranormal Podcast.
Our guest is Chris White. The subject is Ancient Aliens Debunked, his new documentary detailing why he and other folks feel that the ancient aliens theorists are pretty much all wet. And we're so glad to have him on the show to give his viewpoint. Now, Chris, before the break, you talked about what you consider to be intellectual dishonesty. I think you used the phrase outright lies. can you provide us with what you think are some of the more egregious examples of intellectual dishonesty?
Well, I think von Däniken is a perfect example of this. That guy in the research for this, I really lost a lot of respect for him because he doesn't seem to have any scruples in that regard. Good example in the one section, he's quoting from Dead Sea Scrolls text, the Genesis Apocryphon. He calls it the Lamech Scroll. I honestly believe the reason he calls it that is to kind of throw the trail off, so people can't check his facts on this. But, and Sitchin, oh my goodness, we could go a long time on him. But he says that he's trying to promote the idea that this union was how to put this. He essentially says that there was artificial insemination in this text, and he says that in this text, he goes through this entire spiel, and he basically says the exact opposite of what the text says. He says that in this text, Noah, who was a baby in this text, his father doesn't believe that Noah is his son. And so von Däniken makes it seem like when they take it to the elders or whatever, then the person says, oh, this isn't your son. Actually, it's from the watchers, and they artificially inseminated your wife. That's what von Däniken tells people that text says, when in fact the text clearly says, no, this person is your son, and it's definitely not the watchers. And his wife, instead of, as von Däniken says, oh, this can't be your son because you were gone for a long time, nothing like that happens. In fact, the text says she reminds him of the night they conceived it. It's almost a complete and total about face from what the text says, just to sing his song. And in Sitchin's case, this is a guy who is supposed to be the world's greatest translator of the Sumerian text. Almost all of the ancient astronaut theories as we know them today, especially as it relates to the Anunnaki and so forth and Nibiru and all this, comes directly from Zachariah Sitchin. Almost everything, the whole gold from, you know, they came here to mine gold, and all the stuff that's sort of a base level ancient astronaut theory stuff comes from Sitchin. But Sitchin, we now know, well, Sitchin wrote in the 70s and 80s, and the Sumerian texts that were available, especially those that had been, you know, translated and looked at and things like that, were very few. It was a new science. There was almost no way for anybody in the 70s, 80s, 90s, even early 2000s to check his facts. You either had to take Sitchin at face value because he never cited any sources. He never gave any footnotes. He never did anything to let anybody check him out. So you had to either believe Sitchin out of blind faith, or that was your only option, or not believe him. And there wasn't anybody to ask, you know. So nowadays we can see for sure that Sitchin was at best completely incompetent as a research, as a translator, and at worst an intentional deceiver. Now those are big claims, and I'm saying that he was either a terribly incompetent translator of the Sumerian languages, or he was intentionally doing it for some other purpose. And I would direct the person that is upset about that to an excellent website by a guy who actually is an ancient scholar, ancient language scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser, who appears in the film. And you can go to his website, sitchiniswrong.com. He's also been on Coast to Coast a number of times, explaining the various problems. For example, the Anunnaki are never, and you can do a word search for every mention of, for example, the word Nibiru in a planetary context or whatever. It's never mentioned as a planet beyond Pluto. The Anunnaki are never associated with it. It's as easy now to prove Sitchin wrong as doing simple word searches. And that sounds like, oh, how can you know that? But to understand what I'm saying, it is important to check out sites like sitchiniswrong.com.
Some of the arguments that appeal most to a casual observer, maybe someone who has not done a great deal of research but considers themselves a discerning person, is when the ancient alien theorists point to something out of time and place. For example, you know, gears in the fossil record where they shouldn't be by mainstream science, or a boot print in a fossil record where it shouldn't be, or supposedly stone cutting technologies that were beyond, or they say were beyond, the capability of an ancient civilization, those kind of things. How do you answer those points that fall on the side of the ancient alien theorists' ledger?
Sure, good question. The things about, for example, the stone cutting technologies, I've never seen, and I just meticulously researched ancient stone cutting methods as a part of this project, and I never saw anything that was even close to advanced, as we would put it. I mean, for the most part, flat surfaces on rocks as hard as granite or diorite are done with a pretty basic method. First, it's rough cut using a pounding stone, usually diorite for granite, but actually, because of the way certain stones cool, you can do it with other stones, making these trough-like depressions, which are then sanded, not cut. So to make a flat surface like an obelisk, that's not somebody cutting that with a saw. That's somebody that's made a really rough cut first with a lot of people involved, and then taking a flat stone with sand as an abrasive, like sanding it. And sand can polish a flat surface if you have a flat stone on top of it. With stones, the harder the stone is, the better it's polishable. You can see these magnificent diorite statues and things like that that are done unambiguously. I mean, we have plenty of hieroglyphics of them using this method. So in many cases with stone cutting and things like that, it's not actually cutting. It's an abrasive sanding process. But there is cutting, especially in Egypt and in the Americas and stuff like that, with early smelting of copper, especially copper, as in the Americas, they used a lot of copper alloys. In Egypt, copper was somewhat rare because they had to get it. It was hard to get, and it was expensive. But there are, again, plenty of depictions of them using copper saws. These saws didn't even have teeth. What they would use on granite for projects like royal projects, like the granite sarcophagus and the pyramid, it was used in this method of, and they actually messed up. And there's a big gap where the person was sawing in the wrong direction for a while that you can see now on the north side of the sarcophagus. But what basically they would just put sand on top of the granite, and they would use either a drill for boring holes or for sawing, and just moving it back and forth. And that's been tested. It's actually somewhat easy to do. So in the cases where they did actually cut it, you know, it's a pretty well-known process. Now, things like Puma Punku, most of the problem with the ancient astronaut theory, if you see the film, this is the big thing about it, is what is called a false dilemma, basically. They say, for example, with Puma Punku, you know, these angles are too straight. It's too impossible for this to be done. And these stones are too hard to be cut with anything. That's the main thing that they'll say. These stones couldn't be cut with anything but diamonds, you know? Right. And that's it's a false dilemma that they set up first. Okay, these stones couldn't be cut with diamonds, so what could they be cut with? You know, but the first premise was wrong. First of all, that at Puma Punku, it was sandstone and andesite, not granite and diorite, as they say. But the people in the Americas were really good, and Puma Punku particularly, were really good at making copper tools in a variety of shapes and sizes. There's nothing at Puma Punku that couldn't be done with some pretty good chisels. The right angles that they say exist, oh, everything's in a right angle. No, it's not. In fact, you can see them as they go around, ancient aliens, with carpenter squares. They're telling everybody, look at this, it's a right angle. But no time do they actually – you can watch them, and none of them are right angles. They're not all the same – all these things that they say, oh, they're all the same dimensions. Well, no, they're not. And I cite all this stuff in the film with actual, you know, references from scholarly articles, actual experts on Puma Punku and things like that. So you can go find it for yourself. That's the important part. This is what made me start to question all this stuff, is that they know how this was done. They're not baffled by it. Archaeologists have demonstrated – you know, hey, they're doing the same thing. You know, they take the same stone that they found in the quarry, an archaeologist, and in 90 minutes with that stone, make the same cut that ancient aliens say is impossible for anybody to do without diamonds. You know, so we're dealing with in our face evidence that this is something that was well known to them in most cases. Now, out of place artifacts like, you know, the Antikythera mechanism and stuff like that.
Right.
those things are, I mean, with that particular one, I mean, I think it's certainly within the realm of possibility that something like that existed. They certainly had a motive for creating an object like that for sea vessels and stuff like that. It would just take a particular genius to create that. And I think there's some references to similar objects at about that time in 1 BC or whatnot. There's other things you mentioned that I would have to see them and research them before I could, you know, and make sure they're valid before I kind of get into that. But so I take it on a case by case basis with the other stuff.
Why do you think that this theory has attracted the attention of so many people? I mean, I know that it's done quite well on the History Channel program, and obviously Von Däniken has had a series of very successful books, and that continues, and really a resurgence in the last few years with the television series. Why do you think this appeals to people?
I think for several reasons. One, I think that that as I mentioned before, there is something wrong in a sense with the way that history is viewed in the mainstream, and there's a natural rebellion against that. I think that it doesn't, the what is proposed doesn't quite explain all the evidence, and so people are looking for the truth. And so there's a natural appeal in that regard. Here's somebody that's providing something. And I think that it helps to explain a lot of if you want a naturalistic worldview, in a sense, you want to say that, okay, there's nothing odd happening in the sense of, you know, there aren't any, if you will, paranormal things happening. There isn't that kind of stuff happening. You can retain a completely skeptical, naturalistic worldview and also believe in this particular idea, because, you know, it's just, hey, we, you know, there's lots of different civilizations out there. They have technology like us. They came here genetically modified. Even though it sounds weird, it's really still very naturalistic. So it appeals to a very broad audience. And the world, I think, has a pro-naturalistic worldview. So there are several reasons I would go into besides that, but I think that's the main one, is that people are sort of rebelling and want explanations for things that they don't feel satisfied with in terms of the way mainstream history presents it.
When you look at things like the almost religious visions that happen across totally different cultures, separated by thousands of miles, and obviously there was, you know, very little interplay between these different civilizations for thousands of years, just because there was no way for them to communicate. You hinted before at an explanation for it. Is that almost a spiritual or religious explanation, do you think, for these visions?
Well, there's two ways I would go with that. Describe exactly what you mean, or by visions, or the visions and all.
For example, the chariots in the sky. You mentioned before the quote, men coming down right, having sexual relations with women and so forth, those kind of things. How do you explain that? If it's not mainstream science and it's not ancient aliens, is it something religious or spiritual?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would say has to be. Well, I would say it like this, that there's basically the two options that you have for things like, see, it's not just this view that there was a hybridization, that these, what they'll call gods, came down, angels, whatever, they left one form to come down here because they found women, you know, beautiful. They had sex with them, produced offspring. That's told in, from Viracocha to, you know, the story of the Anunnaki stuff. It's a pretty standard line that is not just a Near East thing. It's everywhere. But what's also included in most of those mythologies, the Bible being a good example, is that the destruction of the world via a catastrophic flood was also a result of the hybridization process. So, for example, Viracocha in South America, before he creates humans, he creates giants. He, through a process, he breathes life into these giant stones, creates giants. He doesn't like them, so he sends a flood. In the case of the Anunnaki, they create a hybrid, if you will, that in their terminology, their noise makes the gods angry, so the gods send a flood and all this stuff. And so it's not just we're dealing with a hybridization thing. We're dealing with a hybridization, a flood, and actually I would go one step further. There's also a consistent view that these beings that came down here, had sex with human women, produced offspring, those offspring anger gods, God send a flood. There's one more aspect of that, which is that those beings that initially did that were locked in an abyss as a result of their initial hybridization. Now, that's a pretty complicated, weird story. You wouldn't expect that to be consistent over everywhere. But you can take basic migration patterns, even, standard halotype gene mapping stuff of the way that people migrated, over the land bridge in Alaska and all this stuff. It stands to reason that in this scenario, once you've gotten past the fact of, okay, well, this isn't an accident that they all have this same view. The only options that you have is that they all like viewed this earlier text that we don't know about first. And then they all decided, hey, I want to believe this as like absolute fact. Everybody want to believe this is absolute fact? Okay. And then they go migrate across the world and they spread their sort of slightly varied versions of that story to their children when their children ask, hey, where did we all come from? Or there was an actual event and there was a real event of some kind like that. So what I would say to answer your question is that, yes, that actually happened. And I think that the question that we now have is which one of these ancient texts is closest to the truth? Because now this becomes an issue of who can preserve this story the best via their scribes and things like that. So to get to the truth, I think is in a textual way. Now, is there a possibility that visions could have occurred in a supernatural sense and that sort of passed down in that way? I would say that there are many, like the shamans and stuff like that, there are similar patterns that you can see with people that are doing shamanistic type things, taking drugs and similar things in different cultures. They are also getting similar direction from that aspect. I don't deny that that's true as well, but I think you can actually those are two separate issues in terms of they didn't get that mythology from that. That's a whole other thing we could get into, but I don't want to sidetrack too much.
You talked about the theorists of the ancient aliens movement, if you will. And I think you kind of answered this before, but just to be clear, and again, it's hard to generalize because each person is an individual and different people have different motivations and viewpoints. But on the whole, do you think that the main pushers of the ancient alien theory, do you think they're well-meaning, but they've just, people can get skewed, even in academia, if somebody gets on a theory, sometimes quite innocently, they'll start subconsciously fitting the evidence to fit their theory? Or do you think it's an outright, we're going to twist this whatever way we need to make it fit this theory?
That's a good question too. I would say almost all the people in the show are true believers. And I believe that. I've done a lot of these kinds of things looking into various doctrines and things like this. I did, for example, one called David Icke Debunked. And I'm completely convinced that David Icke is a true believer in everything that he says. However, this is the one area where I would say that the people that started it, particularly Sitchin, not even so much Von Daniken, I could cut him some slack, but he does have some things to answer for that he has knowingly said things that he knows are untrue to promote this. And so he is has some fault for that. But with Sitchin, the nature of the way that he has deceived people with this, and I don't have an out for him. I don't have anything to say about Sitchin is that he intentionally did this. He knew he was deceiving people from the very beginning. That's my view of analyzing the way that Sitchin has deceived people. And he's hidden it in a very interesting way. The way that he presents it is expecting to hide it in a particular way. The best way I can prove that to you is through Heiser's work at SitchinIsWrong.com. If you really study that site and study all the different aspects that are there, there's several different things that are really well detailed there. If you really understand that all that stuff, I don't know how a person could come away with that and say anything except for he knew what he was doing. Now, his motivations for doing that could have been all over the board. I don't know. Maybe they were financial. Maybe they were something else. But there was something, in my opinion.
It's a fascinating topic and fascinating on both sides of the fence. So it is good to have the other perspective. Where can people go and find the video? And once they go there, what will they see?
AncientAliensDebunked.com is the best way to get there. And I encourage people to share that link because the History Channel took down the trailer with, I believe, a false DMCA claim. So I'm not expecting the current uploads on YouTube to be there for very long. But I've got some other uploads that I can embed on the site. So if it's ever down or whatever, the best place to go to find the current upload is the website, AncientAliensDebunked.com. It's also got – at the website, it's thoroughly referenced. There's over 250 footnotes and references to scholarly journals and different places where you can check this out for yourself. The main point of the film is to say to us that we don't need to be deceived like this anymore. This stuff is far too important to get had. We need to be intellectual. I come from what we used to call the truth movement. And the problem with that is that there was so much untruth in the truth movement. And we were the one group in the world that you could tell us anything and we would believe it. And we didn't require evidence or whatever. If we're going to be honest, if we're going to be the truth movement, if we're going to be people that hold ourselves as more intellectual than other people, then we need to start acting like it. And we need to start doing the research for ourselves. Everybody says that, but we need to start doing it.
And I know you also have a podcast network. Since you're on a podcast, and we're a big fan of podcasts of all different stripes, tell us a little bit about that and where people can find that.
Sure. RevelationsRadioNetwork.com, a plural RevelationsRadioNetwork.com, is just a collection of like-minded podcasters. Basically, it's all the stuff is for free. There's no, there's no financial anything going on here. It's just something that we all have a heart for podcasting. We like to do it. So that's what we do. My show is called Nowhere to Run with Chris White. And you can find it. Just simple Google search there.
Very cool. Well, Chris White, we thank you for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast, and an interesting perspective indeed.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Well, regardless of your position, I certainly hope you enjoyed that segment. I thought it was interesting, and I look forward to watching the movie in full and making up my own mind as I suggest you do yours. Next up is James Renner. He's the author of a book called It Came from Ohio. That's my home state. So I thought it might be interesting to you because we have a lot of weird things in Ohio other than just Jim Harold. Here it is. The book that we're going to talk about today is It Came from Ohio, True Tales of the Weird, Wild, and Unexplained. Our guest is James Renner. He is an accomplished writer and author. He's a novelist, freelance journalist, and blogger. In his spare time, he hunts serial killers. His true crime stories have been published in the Best American Crime Reporting and Best Creative Nonfiction Anthologies. His film adaptation of a Stephen King story was an official selection at the 2005 Montreal World Film Festival. A graduate of Kent State University, James lives in Akron, Ohio, just down the road here. And we're so glad to have him with us. James, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, listen closely because later I'm going to tell you how you may have a chance to win a copy of It Came from Ohio. James, you're a crime writer. Why did you decide to delve into the unexplained?
Well, because I built up such credibility, I decided that now would be a good time to tear all that down and start over. I would interview people on these crime stories, and there's something about when a person meets a reporter, right? Where there's this person that they're introduced to that's collecting stories.
Right.
And so they feel like we're the people that, just like a therapist or something, that they can share some things with that they normally don't bring up in typical conversation. So I'd meet these people, I'd interview them about this crime, and then after we were done with the interview, on the way out, they would be like, wait, one more thing. And, they're like, come back here. There's this one thing that happened to me.
Right.
I've never shared it with anybody, but it's a really cool story, and you might want to do a little more research on it. So it just seemed to me that so many people had these little nuggets of stories that they wanted to share that were unexplained or slightly paranormal in their mind or just bizarre. And being a reporter, they wanted to tell me their story. So I started collecting them. And when I had enough, I put it together in a small book. And to me, the most interesting part is not whether or not these stories are, in fact, paranormal. You can draw your own conclusions, you know, whether or not these ghosts are real or these alien invasions really happened in Ohio. But to me, the most interesting thing is the characters that surround these stories, these real people that really believe that they've experienced something that can't be explained, and how that affects them in their day-to-day life.
You know, when I think about places that are mystical or haunted or those kind of things, really, Ohio and northeastern Ohio in particular is not the first place I necessarily think of. You think of Salem and places like that. Did it turn out that this area of the world is a little more paranormal, I guess, or weird than one would think at first glance?
I really think there is something about Northeast Ohio in particular that is just a little off, you know?
Hey, I live here, so.
Right. You know, and not just the sports teams, but there's just something about living here that, you know, we've got the change of the seasons right now, and things look a little spooky when the leaves fall off the trees, and we've got these giant forests of, emptiness. And for one reason or another, it's a hotbed for Bigfoot sightings, for UFOs, for serial killers, for all the things that, creep people out and scare people in the night. And they seem just a little more bizarre than the stories you get from other places in the country. You know, like the melon heads that supposedly live out in Kirtland, that are these genetically modified kids that escape from an orphanage and crave the blood of Boy Scouts up there. And these things just they just wouldn't happen anywhere else. You know, they're native to Northeast Ohio.
Well, I certainly want to talk about some of the stories and share some of the stories with our audience, and we're going to do that right after this message. Talk about something spooky, a commercial, right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. Now, if you've just started listening to my shows and really enjoy what you hear, or maybe you've been listening for a long time, may I humbly suggest my Paranormal Plus Club. You get an archive of over 500 shows. That includes the archives of all the paranormal podcasts and campfires that I've done in the past that are now on the archive side, which are hundreds of programs. Then you get access to well over 100 exclusive programs that I've never made accessible for free. And then you get access to a thing like a paid newsletter. You get access to meet and greets virtually. We get together on the line, and you can ask me questions. Either you type them in, or you can actually say, "Hey, Jim, here's my question," and just ask me via voice. You get access to a great forum section. We also have courses. Just tonight, actually, as I record this, we're going to be doing a tarot class. And the great thing is if you miss them, they're all archived for your perusal later. It is a great time to pick up on the Paranormal Plus Club because it's Halloween, and in Halloween celebration, if you sign up for the yearly plan, this is specifically for the yearly plan, you will get your choice of a free Kindle book, either my campfire book or Annie Wilder's Trucker Ghost Stories book. Now, that's if you sign up for the year. Now, if you don't feel like signing up for the year, if you want to kind of dip a toe in, we have a very economical monthly plan. And the nice thing now, the way we have it set up, we've streamlined our payment and registration system. You can pay directly with your Visa, with your MasterCard, with your Amex, with your Discover, and you can choose PayPal. However, you do not need to go through PayPal. In the past, the way we were set up, everything had to go through PayPal. Not so anymore. we've made the monetary investment, and now you can just directly use your various cards. And so far, we've had great feedback on a new registration and payment system. So we hope you enjoy it. We're always trying to improve it. We're actually going to be lengthening the shows a little bit than what they have been. You get 8 exclusive shows every month that aren't on the free feed, and you get all those other things that I told you about. Plus, if you appreciate what it is that I do, this is basically how I make a living at it, for the most part. So we would appreciate it very much. Check out the Paranormal Plus Club. It's at jimherold.net. And don't forget the special yearly membership bonus offer. It's all at jimherold.net. Thanks.
Be sure to follow Jim on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. Find all the links at jimherold.com. Now back to the Paranormal Podcast.
We are back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is James Renner. His new book is It Came from Ohio, True Tales of the Weird, Wild, and Unexplained. And I was sharing with James before, I was actually familiar with some of his journalism work and had read some exposés he had done, and just a really, really good writer. James, you know, one thing that catches my eye here is the Mothman.
Yeah.
And when I thought about Mothman, I always thought about West Virginia, Point Pleasant, West Virginia, John Keel, the Mothman prophecies, and so forth. I didn't realize there was involvement in Ohio. What did you find about the lore of the Mothman in Ohio history?
Yeah. Well, you know, I discovered that the Mothman's first victim likely came from Ohio. And this is what I really enjoy about these investigations, is you take the story that everybody kind of knows, right? And what I like to do is just do a little more digging and find the history of it. And without fail, you'll find things that haven't been reported before, like this Mothman deal. The story is, the story that I found was that the day before all those Mothman sightings happened over the TNT area in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, which is right across the Ohio River from Gallipolis or Gallipolis or however you pronounce that. It's a small little village in Ohio. And it's right across the river. But the day before all those sightings in Salem, Ohio, which is more towards the center of the state, there was this this man was watching TV, and he all of a sudden his dog started barking. And it's the kind of bark that only happens when there's an intruder, somebody showing up the property when they shouldn't. And it was late at night. It was like around midnight. And the guy goes outside to investigate, brings his dog along with him in case it is somebody trying to break into his house. And as soon as the dog gets outside, it darts off down the field. There's this giant cornfield behind the house. And up on the cornfield, this man says that he reports this later to a journalist, and he says that he sees this thing standing up in the field, the vague shape of a human with these long wings and bright red eyes. And the dog gets up there, and both the dog and this being of some sort disappear in the darkness. And then all of a sudden he hears the yelping of the dog, and you can tell that it's in pain. And then nothing. And the next morning, he goes out there and can't find the dog, can't find a body, can't find anything. Well, if you look at the first reports of the Mothman over in Point Pleasant, the first thing that they talk about is how these sightings took place over by the TNT area. And earlier that day, a police officer was called to get rid of the body of this dog that was found in the field. And it seems like this dog could have been transported by whatever this thing was from Salem, Ohio, down to Point Pleasant. So whether it was this half human, half bird creature or a gigantic owl, which is one of the theories, whatever it was large enough to carry off a dog and carry it for about, what is that, about 60 miles.
Wow. That's interesting. So maybe on his way down to West Virginia, he made a stop off and an appearance in Salem, Ohio.
Right.
One thing for those not familiar with the geography of the northeastern Ohio Cleveland area, we live right on a major body of water, Lake Erie. It kind of fits Erie.
Sure.
And you know, we've talked about on this program cryptozoology, Loch Ness Monster, and so forth, but the Cleveland area has its own claim to fame in terms of a supposed sea serpent. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, this was a story, you know, I got done and I had a dozen stories for this book. And the editor came back and said, you know, this is David Gray at Gray & Company. He said, can you do one more story? It's coming in a little short. We could, and 13 is such a nice number for this type of thing. Why don't you do a story on the monster that supposedly lives in Lake Erie, the sea serpent? It's called Bessie. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. That's ridiculous. There's no way there's any truth in that story. The stuff I like here is at least grounded in reality. I don't want to do anything about the sea serpent.
Right.
Well, just do a little research, see what you can find. So I got into the archives of the Plain Dealer and the Cleveland Register and all the old, you know, the good papers from Cleveland at that time. And I started to uncover these stories that had been lost to time. And I found reports of this some sort of sea serpent living in Lake Erie that date back to the early 1800s. And some of the more interesting sightings involved, it's right at the place where the Sandusky River empties into Lake Erie. And there was this report. This guy had called the Cleveland Register and said, hey, I was walking my dog on the beach yesterday, and I found what I think is a clutch of ostrich eggs. And I brought them back to my house. And these are the biggest eggs I've ever seen. They have to be from an ostrich. Would you come down and take some pictures for your paper? So the reporter drove out to Sandusky that day and went to take some pictures of this guy, these eggs. And he gets there, and the guy walks him into the kitchen. And inside the kitchen, his wife is screaming like she's being attacked. And so they go rushing in there. And on the floor are two giant snakes.
Ooh.
And, like giant snakes. And so they get the snakes away from the woman, get them outside, and they're like, well, where did these snakes come from? And then it dawns on the guy, well, what if they came from the eggs? And they run over to this clutch that this guy had gathered, and two of the eggs had been broken open, and one of them was hatching at that moment. And the reporter watched this giant snake come out of this egg. So the question is, are these the eggs from whatever this thing is that people saw? Is this the eggs from Bessie, the Lake Erie sea monster? And what is it? Is it some sort of unknown giant freshwater eel, like some people have said? Is it a giant muskie? Obviously, those weren't muskies, but it led me to believe that, you know, there is definitely, or at least there was, something in that lake that was unexplained. You know, I don't think it was a dinosaur like some people do, you know, the pterosaurs, but I think there was definitely something there, like some sort of giant eel or giant, you know, prehistoric fish that hung on, you know, for a length of time. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting to me because that story would seem to be a little, maybe, I'm guessing, and you tell me if I'm wrong, a microcosm for probably your experience in doing this. I'm guessing, being a journalist, I think of just the facts. I picture the guy with the hat and the little press card and the notepad, and it's like, yeah, just give me the facts, just give me the facts. Probably very skeptical at nature. Did doing this project as a hard-boiled journalist, did it kind of change you a little bit, and in what way?
Yeah, you know, in some ways, you know, I entered this, you know, just like that story, I entered in as a complete skeptic, and you know, because I didn't believe in this, any sort of sea serpent. And what happened, you know, I think with all these stories is you have, you know, my mind as a skeptic, as a journalist, as somebody that is after the facts, and you have these unbelievable stories about Bigfoot, about UFO, and about sea serpents. And the truth lies somewhere in between, you know, where there is, you know, for instance, that story, you know, maybe there is a giant freshwater eel. That's interesting in itself. It's an eel that we've never found before, like cryptozoology. We'd be excited if we found a new species like that. But it's not a dinosaur, and it's not something from the fifth dimension. So, but, you know, we're getting at something that's unknown. And there are bits of truth in each one of these stories, you know, as weird as they can be, you know, about UFOs and, you know, creatures and secret societies. There's always a nugget of truth there that is fun to dig into.
Well, one thing I want to make it clear, this is not just Northeastern Ohio stories. You mentioned Salem and you kind of take a tour around the state. One of the better known ones that you cover in here is the tale of going down to Columbus and Ohio State University, one of America's great institutions, the WOW signal. Which was just recently in the news because I guess there was going to be a reply via Twitter. Tell us a little bit about the WOW signal and how it was later portrayed in popular culture and entertainment. Yeah, right.
So it's to this day, if you ask reputable scientists if there's any sign of intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, they could point to this incident called the WOW signal that happened in the early 70s down at Ohio State. And to this day, it remains the most credible piece of evidence that suggests that there is intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. And what happened was they had set up this giant radio telescope that they pointed out to the stars to listen to see if maybe there were other planets broadcasting TV and radio, and we could pick them up and watch their TV shows and listen to their radio or something. And you know, it's the best way to look for other planets and other solar systems out there. And what they would do, they had this early computer that only had like 1 megabyte of memory space and RAM, and had these giant cartridges that held the data, and it would go on autopilot. And it would record these signals from space. And what it was looking for was a very small band, narrow band signal that could only be generated by an intelligent race. It's not the background radio waves that they're always getting from the Big Bang. It's not a quasar. It's nothing that can be explained naturally. It's a repeating signal that can only be some sort of radio broadcast. And this computer would take that information it was getting from outer space and adapt it to numbers and letters. And the stronger the signal, the higher the number, the higher the letter. And usually it's just a bunch of zeros and ones and twos and threes, the very background radio stuff. Well, one day it picked up this broadcast from this constellation out near Sagittarius, I think, where when the radio telescope went across it, it picked up this narrow band signal that was so powerful it pushed into the numbers, and it came out as like JA something something something. But any scientist would look at that data and think, oh my gosh, this is irrefutable. This is something that is broadcasting. This is a message. There's information in here. Unfortunately, the computer at the time didn't have the capability of taking in the signal itself so that we could decode it and, you know, like in Contact, you know, build the giant ship that takes us to their planet and we can visit our dead fathers and things like that. So nothing fun like that. But to this day, it remains, it really could have been a broadcast from another planet.
And no discussion of the paranormal would be complete unless we talk about the topic of ghosts. And you have a chapter here called Goodnight Gracie, The Angry Ghosts of Hauer House Hate Men. Tell us about those men hating ghosts.
Yeah. You know, there's this, it's the perfect setup for a horror movie, and I may do something with it one day because it's just so perfect. But on the campus of the University of Akron, Akron University, there is this giant Gothic-looking Victorian house with the widow's walk, and it's just in the middle of this campus, this modern-day campus, is this old, creepy house, and it's called Hauer House, and it was originally owned by this guy, John Hauer, who was a kind of a competitor of Kellogg back in the day, made a lot of cereal, and became rich in Akron and built this house for his wife, Susan. And he told Susan, he said, look, you're the love of my life. You're the only woman I will ever marry. Even if you die, if something were to happen to you, I will never remarry. And of course, she gets, you know, diphtheria or typhoid fever or something like that that people die of in the late 1800s, and she dies. And very short time later, he remarries and brings another woman in the house. Well,
uh-oh.
Yeah, ever since then, something has been haunting Hauer House, according to the women that lived there. And here's the horror movie twist. In 1973, the descendant of John, I believe it was his granddaughter, I don't think it was direct daughter, but a woman named Grace Hauer, willed the house, gave the house to the university, but she had a stipulation. She said, at all times, it will be staffed by two young women who are students of the university. You can give them free room and board, and they can take care of the house during the week, and you can show it on the weekends. But under no circumstances are they allowed to bring men into the house, and certainly not overnight. Well, you know, of course, these young women over the years eventually brought their boyfriends over. And every time a man is brought into the house, the energy of the house, they say, really picks up and strange things happen. They can hear the piano playing at night. They can they see, you know, the eyes on Gracie's picture follow them across the room. And then I spoke to this woman named Ashley, and she had invited her boyfriend over one night. And they were sitting in her bedroom, and there's a window on her door that leads out into the hallway, and they saw this old woman walk by, both of them, and they both, you know, kind of sat up, saw this. Later that night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, the man is woken up trying to scream, and he can't get anything out because the cover, the sheet, has been wrapped around his neck, and he's almost like getting strangled. And so that's what happens. These women say whenever a man comes into the house, and the rumor is that this is Susan's ghost trying to exact revenge on men for the way that she was jilted once she died, and her husband remarried and brought another woman into the house. So, but if you ask the staff people that run the place, they will say no, there's no ghost here, no, absolutely no ghosts here, and that's because they don't want these ghost hunter shows to come in and make it a big deal. They want to have weddings there.
You know, that's an interesting take on it, because a lot of times, for example, haunted hotels, we've talked about those quite a few times, and there's some hotels that will embrace it, for example, and say, yeah, we've got ghosts here, and by the way, we have the ghost hunting package. Right. And you have places that will say, what are you talking about, for just the reason that you stayed. So I think it's interesting when you look at, from a business perspective, when you look at the way that they approach it. Well, one thing, we do want to give this offer to folks. Certainly we recommend you pick up the book, but we're going to have a special opportunity for you to win a book. If you sign up for my email newsletter, free email newsletter over at jimherold.com, everybody that's on that list will be eligible. We have two hard copy books, and everybody's eligible, including people from outside the U.S., because if something happens in your, let's say, in Australia, and you win, obviously we're not going to ship a book over there. But James, I know it's also available on Kindle, so I'll spring for the $3.99, and I'll email you a Kindle copy if you win from overseas. So we have two hard copies, and if we need to, a Kindle copy. So just go over to jimherold.com, sign up for my free newsletter at the top of the page, and everybody who's on that list, and let's say I will do the drawing a week from, we're taping on the 12th. On the 19th, I'll do the drawing, so sign up before then, and you'll be in the drawing to possibly win this really fun book. James, along that line, tell people where they can pick the book up and where they can find more information about you on the web.
Sure. Yeah, well, if you live in Ohio, you can pick the book up in any local bookstore. You can always get it online. My first novel, which is a murder mystery set in Ohio, with some elements of the supernatural and sci-fi, came out in March, called The Man from Primrose Lane. And you can pick that up in any bookstore in the country. You can also get that online. Check that out. It's a fun read. And for any other information, just check out my website. It's jamesrenner.com. And all the good stuff's there.
And that's jamesrenner.com. Well, James, we thank you for being a guest on the Paranormal Podcast today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. We certainly appreciate it. Happy Halloween, and we will talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.